Hi, good afternoon everyone. My name is Nicole Gamarov and I'm from Swiss Re. And today I have the pleasure of introducing Carly van der Akker, who happens to also be one of my colleagues. So Carly is, she's been working in the insurance industry for over 10 years, both in Australia and in the UK. Carly has extensive experience in occupational rehabilitation field, working as a senior rehabilitation case manager across a wide range of disciplines. That includes workers' compensation, CTP, and income protection. So she's one of those people that's worked both in the life industry and in the general insurance industry. Carly holds a Bachelor of Applied Science, a Cert 4 Occupational Health and Safety, and is a Certified Disability Management Practitioner. In 2012, Carly was awarded the Turks Legal Aluka Scholarship for the research paper she did on the benefits of early intervention in claims management. Carly also authored Swiss Re's benchmarking rehabilitation report called Rehabilitation Watch, and I think she actually has some reports here with her. She also represents the industry, so that's the reinsurance and insurance industry, on the Australian Signatory Steering Group for the Health Benefits for Good Work. So today we're going to hear from Carly about driving successful claims outcomes using innovative practice. So over to you, Carly.
Thank you, and it's nice to see a few familiar faces. And as you heard from my bio, I put my hand up. I am not an actuary, but I do have a few facts and figures in this presentation. So what I want to talk to you today about is some of the research that Swiss Re is doing in claims management. It applies it to life insurance and to workers' comp. And why the reasons that we've come about getting to the point where we thought that research was a good idea. So I'm going to cover a little bit on contemporary claims management, and if you've been to a whole lot of the sessions over the past 2 days, you've probably heard quite a bit about the biopsychosocial factors that drive claims performance. So I won't cover that in too much detail. Next, we'll talk about the actual research that Swiss is doing. And then finally, we'll round up with how we engage with some of our key stakeholders. And predominantly, we're talking about the employers and the doctors. I'll focus on employers, as I think as insurers, we have a really great opportunity to be able to engage with employers. And then as Nikki kindly spoke at this morning, we'll talk about the importance of getting our customers engaged in the health benefits of good work. So a little bit of scene setting for life insurance, for those of you who don't or haven't worked in life insurance before. And when I was in workers' comp, I did a lot of complaining about this problem and that problem. And then when I got to life insurance, I went, wow, the problems are like 30-fold. So if you have a look, probably I'll focus on the top three. So you can see the immediate or early notification of claim, which in workers' comp you get quite early, and CTP to an extent. In life insurance, and particularly income protection, that is a massive no. So there's no sort of early intervention. For example, most of our waiting periods on our policies are 30, 60, 90, 180 days. And if you look at the group insurance market, where through superannuation or if you have an employer that has salary continuance, some of our notification timeframes in that space are over 200 days. So it's pretty crazy, and definitely not too much scope for early intervention. We just talk about intervention and doing something. The next one down is the ability to fund treatment. And when I worked in workers' comp, that was one of the great things, that we could have somebody who was injured or ill. They'd come to us and we would say, we can fund 8 sessions of physio or some CBT, life insurance. We don't have that luxury, and we are prohibited by legislation in doing so. And I think that forms one of the major barriers around people saying they can't afford treatment or they can't get access to treatment. The last one there is the legislation to influence participation. And when people come from workers' comp to life insurance, they're like, wow, no legislation, we can do what we want. And yes, that is sort of true. But it also comes as a detriment. So we can't actually force or influence people to participate in return to work and rehab. We need to sort of tap into their motivation. So quite a few challenges. And the other thing is that income protection is a relatively static benefit. So age 65 policies, for example, you get 75% of your monthly income until age 65. We have 2- and 5-year benefits, which are slightly better, but that benefit stays the same, stays at 75%. It doesn't step down. So there's no disincentive, I guess, for people to stay on benefits. And in the olden days, before my time in life, we actually used to write lifetime benefits, so age 99. So you can imagine getting paid 75% of your income till then. Crazy. Also, I guess in the last couple of years, if you've read the newspapers, you may have seen some of these headline news stories. And some of the sessions I've been in today have talked about workers' comp and declining claims and the impact of lawyers and all that sort of thing, and the fact that we're getting all these great outcomes where declining claims or people might be going back to work or leaving the workplace. And what we're seeing in life insurance is actually all those people, or a lot of them, are shifting over into our space. So we're managing them, and we're seeing some of these headline losses. We're now starting to come to the end of it. But what Swiss Re did in response to the poor performance was to go and do a lot of portfolio deep dives and try and nut out exactly what was going wrong. So we've got lots around tightening up our definitions and that sort of thing, but one of the big things was the claims management focus. And one of the things we saw was a term that we're now calling duration drift, which I'm sure is not new for you in workers' comp. So like workers' comp, we use the online duration prediction tools like the MDA or the MDG and the ODG. And these things rely on the diagnosis. And as Norman Swan talked about this morning, it relies on the correct diagnosis, and that is often a challenge, particularly with mental health. It relies on us knowing the nature of the work that that person's employed in. And then we have the opportunity to multiply the duration due to the compensation environment. What we see in life insurance is that this is influenced by the waiting periods, the notification lag, so that at least 200 days to actually get the claim to the insurer to then be able to start any sort of intervention, the inability to fund treatment, and the bottom one there is the AAL, so automatic acceptance. So we're very inclusive in life insurance, and if you join an employer or you have income protection inside your superannuation, we welcome everybody with their pre-existing conditions and their comorbid conditions, and even people who have been on workers' comp and have a current workers' comp claim are then automatically accepted under cover for income protection. So as you can imagine, that's an actuary's worst nightmare. And we have a look at why our assumptions around return to work based on those duration prediction tools are wrong. And we're paying out massive reserves, and we're suffering huge losses. If you look at this graph, which was referred, or the research was referred to this morning around the health benefits of work position statement from the faculty, you can have a look at the graph there, and we've probably seen this before. As time goes on, the chances of people returning back into the workforce goes down. And when we saw the return to work pancake results, this is probably when we look at people a long way down the track and they are unable to return to work. Down the bottom in the little orange parts there, you've got some boxes that relate to life insurance. So firstly, the first box says the waiting period, so the average waiting period, we'd say 45 days. If you read that on the graph, after 45 days off work, the chance of us getting that person back to work is 50%. So that's best case if we got them at the end of their waiting period. And in life insurance, that very rarely happens. And if you look at the very end, we've got the start of the rehab program. And as Nicole mentioned, I was fortunate enough to do some research about how we use rehab and return to work services in life insurance. And one of the things that I found that was very scary was that on average it takes us a year to get somebody into an externally led rehab program. So that graph you can see is pretty much flatlined down at zero. So we're really up against it if that's where we're starting from. So just a quick refresher on the biopsychosocial model for those that don't know. So we talk about duration not being black and white. So we don't just use the information that we get on the claim form or the medical certificate. We have a look at the colourful factors that make somebody unique, and those factors are the biopsychosocial factors. And it really talks to the fact that these three things that determine a person's health, we don't manage those as mutually exclusive events. We have a look at the person as a whole, and we look at them as a sum of their biomedical components, so often the diagnosis and their health. We look at their psychological landscape, and we look at the social environment that they fall under. And that, if we look at a person that way, we have much more of an explanation as to why a person A with a broken leg, who would go back to be a factory worker, recovers very differently to the person B with the same broken leg to a similar job at a different employer, and their recovery is very, very different. And again, something that we can't put too much science behind, and the reason why we then progress to our research. So, what we did, and this is first started in the UK in our income protection team there, which is a little bit more similar to workers' comp because they don't have workers' comp over there, but they can pay for treatment, and a lot of their income protection is based within employers. So the left-hand graph there shows the diagnosis split, and what we did was take a whole lot of new claims that came in from our group insurance policy for a big financial institution. And interestingly, you can see there about 50% of them were primary diagnosis mental health. And as I've heard quite a few times today, there is a growing number of people who suffer mental ill health in Australia particularly, but we don't see too many of those through workers' comp and CTP start off that way. They might become secondary site claims, but we do see heaps and heaps of them in the life insurance space. Then we're followed by musculoskeletal, cancer, neurological and other. So we're up to about 300 claims now, and what we did was go through those claims when they came in and had one of our rehab professionals ring them and ask them a question set in a conversational way, applying some behavioural economics techniques to try and elicit some of these biopsychosocial factors. So we have 21 questions that our Chief Medical Officer and our R&D team came up, and they're a combination of various tools that are out there. And asked them the questions and pitched it in a way to say, this doesn't actually determine the liability of your claim. It's about how that we can help you to recover and return to work. And we found by asking the questions in that format, people are more likely to respond genuinely, whereas if we ask them and they think it determines their liability, they're more likely to portray themselves in quite a disabled and needy way. After we'd asked the questions, we then looked at those same set of claimants 6 months later and looked at who had returned to work and who hadn't. And you see that there on the right-hand graph, or my right. So you can see there it's around about a 50-50 split approximately. I'm not an actuary. I know there's some differences. But you can see 50% of the people with mental health returned to work, and around about the other 50% of them didn't return to work, regardless of the treatment that was provided or the usual care that they received, and mild to moderate mental health rather than we excluded things like schizophrenia and the very severe mental illness. So what did that tell us? What was the difference between the two groups? And what we found with quite strong reliability was there was 5 biopsychosocial factors that actually predicted the likelihood of somebody returning back to work. And it had nothing to do with the diagnosis, it had nothing to do with the treatment that they received, but it had a lot to do with these 5 things. So the first one was, and the most significant one, the strongest predictor, was the high expectation to return to work. So if people were asked, did they think they were going to go back to work, and they really believed that they would, they had a good understanding of their workplace and what they needed to do to get back, they were more likely to be back at work in 6 months. If they had a strong work ethic, they were more likely to be back. If they were able to cope well with their illness or their injury, or they displayed good coping skills in general, whether they had low fear avoidance behaviours or a fear on the fear avoidance scale, they were more likely to be back at work. And lastly, if they had a high self-efficacy, so a lot of self-belief in their ability to return to work, we found that those people were more likely to be back at work. So we thought, that's quite interesting, regardless of the diagnosis, and looking at people who had cancer and neurological conditions, which is different to workers' comp, I know, but you see in workers' compensation there's a lot of blame that goes on, that someone else's fault that they're injured or ill, whereas cancer and neurological things often happen to people without reason. So for them to display similar biopsychosocial factors, we're quite confident that those are the sort of things that attribute the likelihood that someone's going to return to work. So what are we doing with this? Now that we've gone through around about 300 claims, we're replicating a similar study in Australia. And the tough thing is, in Australia, and I guess in the UK, we just want to do something about it. So now we know this, why can't we just go out and do it? But we really want to validate that these are the factors that we should be targeting. So in the UK, what they're doing is using a scoring matrix to put those claimants into buckets. So either low risk of long-term disability, medium or high risk. And what we're doing with the low risk is actually nothing, because those people are more than likely to return to work on their own without our assistance. So they've got good work ethic, they're positively expecting that they will return to work, all those sort of things. And actually we're finding that people who we give intervention to that don't actually need it can often end up worse than when we started. So playing with them when we don't need to intervene actually means that their duration of claim is longer. So we're leaving those ones on the most part. And what we're doing is focusing our energies on the medium and high risk individuals. And instead of just doing standard rehab, so your bog standard workplace assessment, graduated return to work plan, maybe some job seeking, we're thinking differently about how we can try and modify those BPS factors. So things like, you heard from Deborah from the Centre for Corporate Health, they have a provider arm called Resilia. So we're looking at offering resilience programs for people to try and rebuild their resilience so they're more likely to bounce back in the face of adversity. We're using techniques like mental health occupational therapy, focusing on functional restoration for mental illness, mindfulness, positive psychology and CBT. So all the things that we kind of think are good ideas, but we're actually going to put them into practice and see if they change those modifying factors. The other thing, I guess, is that we need to make sure that what we're doing has a cost benefit. So we're not just throwing resilience programs and that sort of thing at people who don't really need it. And what we found in Rehab Watch in the benchmarking study was that at the time we did that, through normal rehabilitation, either provided inside life insurers, so their own rehab teams, or by providers, we found that for every dollar that we invested in those rehab services or interventions, we were saving around about anywhere between $24 and $39 in claims costs, so reserve release for those people who we got back to work earlier. And again, not an actuary, but I'm pretty sure that's a good return on investment. And as long as I've been working in rehab, we've always been asked to prove our worth and why should we employ rehab people and what do they do? And I think now starting to be able to justify the fact that we can add value and it is a person-centred business. So insurance, no matter the jurisdiction in personal injury, it's about people and that's what rehab really focuses on. And there's heaps and heaps of other tools and companies out there that are doing similar sort of things. So we really wanted to try and prove our worth and give that intervention to those who really need it and that we really know that we can make a difference on. So we'll keep you posted on how the intervention stage goes. So that's for claims already made. The other side of life insurance, the non-group insurance, is retail insurance. So if you were to buy a policy through your bank or through your financial advisor or you dialed up extra levels of cover, you've probably been sent out a form that looks like this and goes on for about 35, 50 pages. If that's sounding familiar, then you know you've gone through retail underwriting. And if you look at these forms, one, they're not really that easy to understand, but two, you need to go and see a doctor. And they're very, very focused on medical factors. So you can see pre-existing conditions that you might have. You can see family history of chronic disease. You can see mental health. But what you don't see is any of those questions around those biopsychosocial predictors. So what if we ask people some questions around their resilience or their levels of optimism, even going back to childhood, childhood temperaments and just thinking, were you a kid that was glass half empty or glass half full? So we can kind of get an idea if that person did have a claim based on all the medical factors that we have, the risk, what is the likelihood that they're going to recover as we expect, as the actuaries assume, or is there something about them in their biopsychosocial profile to say, actually, they may not recover as we expected? So those are just a couple of factors. The other one that we've talked about a bit today at the conference is the workplace factors and the role of the employer in all of this. So what can we do to help the employers to understand what they actually do is very, very important in the big scheme of things. I'm not going to go through this again, but is everybody familiar with the Health Benefits of Good Work consensus statement? And I'm going to emphasise the word good there. So lots of people talk about the health benefits of work, and just recently we've seen the inclusion of the word good into that, because going back to bad work is actually more dangerous on your health or health risk than being unemployed. So we need to make sure that we're returning people back into good work, and that requires the involvement of the employer. But how do the employers know that what they're doing in their workplace is actually good? And how do we combat those long-term health risks that being out of work? And you might have seen some of the behavioural economics messages around the fact that long-term worklessness is the equivalent health risk of smoking 10 packets of cigarettes a day. So those kind of statistics are pretty sobering for people who are looking at long-term unemployment. It's not only the loss of financial stability, it's those health risks that really, really make a difference. And people like Black Dog and Beyond Blue are really going on about the importance of young men in work. So being out of work for more than 6 months for somebody under 30, a male under 30, increases their suicide risk 40-fold. So those kind of figures are horrible, and I think we have a massive opportunity as insurers to really work with our employers to re-emphasise the value that work can actually bring. So who remembers the premium discount scheme if you worked in New South Wales? Those things you remember. And there's heaps of questions. We used to go and do audits around, do they have a fall prevention system? Have they got their right policies and procedures up on the wall? Heaps and heaps about lost time injuries and really having a look at those factors, the safety factors that we could see and that we could measure, but less or pretty much nothing on the psychological risk factors. So what actually about that workplace was the employer doing to minimise the risk of psychological harm to people? And a lot of those psychological risks are the things that make work good. So underneath the position statement here, the umbrella statement, the health benefits of good work, which many of your organisations are signatories to, and I'll point out that just being a signatory doesn't mean a lot unless you're willing to do something with it. So you sign your life, so you might as well do something with the information, and I think that's what Swiss Re is trying to do with the Signatory Steering Group, with Nikki Ellis, is trying to get the message out there and change behaviour. Under that main umbrella statement, though, we've got a couple of other supporting statements. You can download all of these from the faculty website. The first one, and the one I want to talk about, is what is good work and what makes work good. So there's actually a whole evidence base about the factors that make work and workplaces good. And those are not in order, but just in general, there's 6 factors. And again, we heard about control. So workplaces where the employees feel like they have some sort of control over what they do, so they're not made to sit in a corner and do something and they've got no opportunity to feedback into what they're doing. So workplaces with good control is important. The next one is demands. So we're not overloading our workers. They feel like they can cope with the demands of their job, both from a quality and a quantitative perspective. They're supported to be able to do that as well. The next one is change, and again, we see this is huge in our landscape, is the ability for employers to embrace change and to involve the employees on the journey of change. So not just doing stuff and expecting the employees to get along with it, but to be able to consult and regularly make sure that they're involved in the change process. The role, and I'm sure none of us want to go to work and think, oh, I don't really know what my role or my responsibilities are. We go to work for a reason, and it's a lot around our sense of identity. So if employers can identify what it is about that person's role that contributes to their bigger picture and their deliverables, we find that people are far more engaged. A very, very important one is relationships. So again, I think Caroline Howe mentioned that one of the best employers that she'd worked for was the CRS, and they had their morning tea where they all got together and chatted. So having a social workplace where people feel accepted and they've got good relationships is really, really important. And we are starting to have that challenge with remote working and agile workplaces and all that sort of thing. But the value of having good workplace relationships is very, very important. And it extends beyond just your co-workers and your peers and your managers. It goes down to make sure that employers have got policies and procedures that prevent bullying and harassment, and they have procedural fairness and all that sort of thing that makes a workplace psychologically safe for people. And the last one, and my biggest reason why I think it's a great opportunity to speak here, is support. And workplaces that support people back into the workplace are those that we think are leading the way. And it doesn't matter, in my book, what the liability is. So we spend a lot of time saying, oh, it's your liability, or it's workers' comp, or it's life insurance, or it's CTP. But we think about that person at the centre of their return to work journey, and how is it that we can support them regardless of liability as an employer and put them back into good work? And one of the things that I find when I go into a life insurance office and ring up an employer to talk about return to work, I ask, oh, Joe Smith is ready to return to work. Would you be able to supply some light duties and a return to work plan? And 99% of the employers say, I'd like to, but we've saved up all our light duties for workers' comp because it's legislated and they have to. Whereas I'd love to be able to ring up and say, oh, great, we really want Joe Smith to come back to our workplace, so we've actually made these duties available to him and we understand the value that graduated return to work brings. That would be awesome. The other thing we see in life insurance quite often is that the employer, because they don't have a liability, they say they have to be 100% fit before they come into the workplace. And that flies in the face of all the research that talks about graduated return to work and going from zero and stepping back up fitness rather than zero to 100%. And their reason for 100% fit is that they don't want someone back in the workplace who's going to pose them a workers' comp claim risk. So we have all these reasons not to support people, but I think we have a great opportunity to really support people back into the workplace. And Alex Colley did a really great presentation yesterday around a health model. And if we look at focusing on health outcomes, the cost savings will come, whereas we're very focused on cost savings and cost containment, and we're not really seeing those health outcomes. So I think the reversal needs to happen. Lastly, in summary, I think this sums it up pretty well. So return to good work is good for everybody. We think it's good for workers because of all of those health benefits that being employed provides, and also they're obviously financially better off. But the health benefits, in a lot of senses, outweigh the financial. It's good for the economy, particularly for employers. So when we talk to employers, particularly when I used to work in workers' comp, they had a great understanding about every dollar they spent on claims was $4 in premium. So they knew that they needed to manage claims effectively. And they looked at those tip of the iceberg costs, so the claims costs and the premium costs. Similar sort of thing happens in group life insurance. But we need to speak to employers about all of the below the iceberg things. So the impact on staff morale that not having someone back in the workplace has, or the retrenchment and recruitment costs of replacing workers who leave, and even the brand impact of not having people back in the workplace. I can think of a really good example of a mining company that we do some life insurance work for, and we had one of their staff, female, go off to Bali, and she fell into a swimming pool, slipped into it and landed on her neck and became an incomplete tetraplegic. She was a financial accountant for this mining company, and we did heaps and heaps of work to organise her return to work plan, and we got her back into the workplace in the CBD. And she worked there for about 3 months. We got her car modified, and she was able to drive to the workplace and do her accounting role in the city. And after about 4 or 5 months, we had the executive director ring up and say, actually, I need my car spot back. I don't I want to be able to park right under my building. It's an inconvenience for me to park across the road. So our poor life insured person lost their car park and obviously then just thought it was all too hard and that wasn't a very supportive workplace. And the brand impact that has had on that company, phenomenal, and the risk of things like industrial relations action and all that sort of stuff. So all those things that happen below the iceberg is our responsibility to try and inform employers about the fact that it's not just about cost containment, it's about your employer, and you're an employer of choice, and how is it that you can make your work good. One final plug before questions. Because we are so passionate about returning to good work, we've partnered with the ICA to offer an award program, which we also do in our life insurance book, for people who work in getting people back into work for insurance companies, called the Excellence and Innovation in Return to Work Award. So what this is we're encouraging claims teams, rehab teams, even actuaries. So I've seen some good examples of how actuaries can be involved in return to work, to write a submission about something different that you're doing to try and engage people back with the workforce. And the first prize is a trip to Malaysia next year for the International Forum of Disability Management. So if you're keen or you're doing something innovative in your world, then we would love you to apply. I've got a whole heap of brochures here at the front if you would like one. There's also my email address on there. And one of my favourite quotes, and Nicole actually reminded me of this, was Patch Adams. Has everyone seen Patch Adams or remembers the movie? Towards the end, he gets called up in the medical tribunal about why he's opened a house to look after these terminally ill people, and they accuse him of providing a hospital service when it's not a hospital. And he goes through the whole lot of arguing back and forth about facts and figures, and he says this one thing which changes their mind. So he says, you treat a disease, you win, you lose. You treat a person, I guarantee you win, no matter the outcome. And for me, in life insurance and any personal injury jurisdiction, I think if we treat people as people, we're customer-centric and we're not looking at trying to save money, or we're just not looking at a black and white diagnosis, we're more than likely to get engagement and get good outcomes. Thank you.
Thanks, Carly. I found that very interesting, even though I thought I knew a lot about what you were going to say. And I think the key takeout for me is, you know, as actuaries, we can be involved in data analytics. And there was a bit of a debate yesterday about analysis paralysis. But sometimes that actually compounds the problem. And I think Carly's takeaway message for me certainly is that you have to have the IQ and the EQ to win this battle. So some of us need to work on our EQ, but at least we know now. So in terms of questions, I thought I might kick off. We've probably got about 10 minutes. Carly, you're one of the few people, I guess, that has the benefit of having worked both in the life insurance industry and in the general insurance industry. And it strikes me as a loss that the two sectors don't work more closely together. What do you think we can do to work more closely and learn from each other?
So that's a really great question, and I think a lot of the reason why I got the job at Swiss Re to be able to bring some of the workers' comp learnings into the life space. And what we found when we were doing those deep dives that I mentioned around after we'd suffered all the big losses in the market was around about, I think it was about almost as high as 60% of the income protection claims that we looked at from the group market were actually workers' comp claims to start with, and they may have still been receiving workers' comp benefits when we looked at it. So I think there's an opportunity for insurers to work together. So the sharing of rehab reports, of medical examinations that help people recover, rather than this, oh, you pay for that and we'll pay for this and we're not sharing anything. And then that person's return to work journey is so segmented and disjointed, I guess. But there's a real opportunity for us to be able to have one journey for that person, to be able to share within privacy regulations, share that information and make sure that we're thinking about the person and thinking out how we best help them. And hopefully that will result in claims duration savings rather than the mentality of, oh, yeah, we've declined it under workers' comp, we won't worry about it. But actually, we're all going to pay for it somehow, because if they come into life insurance, we all now have compulsory TPD cover in superannuation, a lot of us income protection. And if you've looked at your super statement, you'll see the cost of insurance that's mandatory going up and up and up, and that is because we're having negative claims experience. So we are going to pay for it. So why don't we work together and work out how we can save the cost at the front end?
So, no, I don't think that's working. It's up to the audience now. If anyone has any questions, I think by now you know the microphone in the middle of the room is for your use. So, are there any questions? And please identify yourself.
Thanks, Carly. That was a really interesting presentation. It's Julie Hill from Safe Work Australia. I'm interested in how you work with employers and how you get, I mean, your emphasis on returning to good work, both in sort of the preventative but also in employers supporting workers back to work.
That's a great question. So we do a lot of promotion around the health benefits of good work, and as part of the signatory steering group, what we're doing at the moment is putting together some business cases of what best practice looks like for employers. So thinking about modifying workplace injury management programs, not just to be for workers' comp, but to include any sort of injury or illness, and having that commitment to help people regardless of liability back into the workplace. So a lot of it is around education, and a lot is also around the numbers. So for a lot of our group insurance renewals, we go back and we say, remember here where you didn't want to have anyone back at work and you thought, oh, well, someone else will deal with it, compared to now when you're offering your suitable duties, not just for workers' comp, but also for your income protection people, the increase in your premium is minimal, if anything, and all that's got to do with is the industry moving rather than the claims experience. So I think some people respond to numbers, some people respond to the intangible benefits, I guess, of having an engaged workforce. And I think case studies and showing good employers in that sort of light is really a powerful tool for others to sort of learn from it.
Thank you for that. That was really, really exciting to hear about the work that you're doing, and I can't wait to hear more about that next phase. It struck me when you were just answering that previous question that poor financial literacy seems to be a big issue. And I think, I don't know, it was a surprise to me in the last couple of years learning more about super and, the you know, I finally opened my super statement, which I had just been filing away, and saw that there were huge premiums coming out for life insurance. So I wonder what you think about how we improve financial literacy to do what you're hoping to achieve, which is to help people understand that this is not free money, that we're all paying for this.
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think what we've seen it work the wrong way. So we've seen with the New South Wales workers' comp changes and the changes to legal fees or the supplementary legal fees, what we saw was that the lawyers decided that life insurance was a good place to go. And we had a look in our deep dive to the point where we looked at when your superannuation statements went out, and then a month later also we would get envelopes of claims from different plaintiff law firms who have gone through and targeted people in that super scheme saying, did you realise that you had this cover? So I think that really hurt us, but at the same time we now combat that sort of message with, if you make your claim directly and you are eligible to claim, why don't you get your full entitlement to your benefit rather than losing 30 or 40% of it to those plaintiff lawyers, and that is how much they take out of total and permanent disability payments, so why don't they make a valid claim and get their 100% benefit? But I think some of the things that the industry is doing to try and improve the financial literacy of people in a positive way is things like, there's a few financial advisors who are offering free financial advice through people like the Cancer Council. So if people do have cancer, they can look on the Cancer Council website and there's financial advisors there who offer free financial advice to them and goes through what they need to be able to pay for treatment, to be able to make sure their income's covered. So being able to access free services like that is really important. And because we don't pay for treatment, we currently have what we call for our clients the claims guide, and it's like an evidence-based platform where our insurers can go in and log on and look at different types of claims, and they can find the best places to direct people for free support in the community, and one of those is definitely the insurance that they can access. So I think those kind of things help people who are in need of claim, but what we find is that it's the people who actually don't need to claim, those are the ones that we don't manage to target, to know, to give them the advice that this is what your insurance covers, this is how you access your claim benefits, and this is why you've got that cover. So I think definitely a massive learning, and even if you look at those 30 and 40 page application forms, we need to make it simpler for people to understand.
Rob Auerbach, really impressed with the fact that the life industry is trying to educate employers, because that's been a hole that hasn't been covered particularly well by workers' comp. But I'm also interested in whether or not there's any attention being spent with regard to the partners of the people who are disabled or seeking those benefits, because particularly with regard to the health benefits of work, it seems to me that their participation and support could make a massive difference in the kind of outcomes that you're seeing.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think I've seen pockets of it, but I couldn't sort of put my hand down and say, yes, I definitely see there's things going on. I know what we look at for a lot of our psychological claims with employers who have EAP is looking at making it known that even though that person can't afford treatment or can't access treatment through life insurance, the employer has an EAP program, and that includes partners. So for people who are going through psychological injury, we look at those cases from the very first go through the biopsychosocial factors, and if they have a partner where they're in a relationship, and I guess even looking at our psych claims, I could probably say that more than 50% of them have some sort of relationship breakdown or dependency on alcohol or drug use because of the length of time that they've been incapacitated and not received support. So I think we've got a great opportunity to try and get people engaged with those support networks and think about partners, and that's part of the biopsychosocial screening, is that we try and look at the person and individually, do you have a great support system, do you not, is it not helpful? And I think we see equally amount, the same amount of people who have what we call cotton wool support, where it's you stay home, don't do anything, and we'll bring everything to you. And I think they pose just as much of a challenge as people who don't have support. But great question.
Probably have time for one more question, if anyone has a question. So, Carly, Carly, I just had a question about technology. So I was recently following the NDIA, had a technology conference in Brisbane, and I was just amazed at how much the IT sector has done for the disability sector. And I'm just wondering, how can we leverage technology to achieve better claims outcomes?
I remember going to an ANZIF presentation not so long ago, and if anyone's ever seen the ANZIF presentations about how far the insurance industry is behind everybody else in terms of digital communication and social media, it's pretty embarrassing. So we thought at Swiss that we might do something to try and improve where we sit with customers. And what we ended up doing is partnering with a major university and their MBA students to look at a customer-centric project for them. So we gave them a problem statement, which was around how do we actually connect people with their insurer to help them on their return to work journey instead of just relying on them to go make a claim and wait for the claim forms. So a group of about 20 students broke into small groups, and they went out and interviewed loads and loads of customers who have been on claim through workers' comp, life insurance, any sort of claim scenario, doctors, chiros, you name it. They probably interviewed 300 people or 400 people. And what they came up with in their four little groups was four technology solutions to try and help injured people engage with their insurer. And combining principles of behavioural economics and the biopsychosocial questions, what we're looking now to do is to design an app so that when somebody needs to make a claim, they can go to their insurer website and download the app. And what that app then helps them to do is lodge information, to get a return to work plan, to make sure that they can communicate via web chat with their insurance claims person, and they have access to information at their fingertips. And it's that having it on their smartphone and engaging, particularly with Gen Y and everybody else who has smartphones, which is most of the population, to make sure that person is connected in with that case manager and they know they're not just a number, they've got a way to communicate and they've got a path and a goal that's been set together, and they work through that claims process on their app. So stay tuned when that comes out. We will let you know. The ideal is that we're going to make it white label so we can look at insurers and working with their claim system, because there's so much value that comes behind from the insights that the information that's input onto those apps. So as an example, the biopsychosocial questions, if we can get that information to the insurer very quickly to say this is low, medium and high risk, they can start their intervention as soon as they get the claim rather than going through all of the other methodologies that happen at claims assessment time.
So, everyone, I don't know about you, but I'm left with a lot more hope than I was left this morning after the plenary session when it was all doom and gloom. Carly has given us hope. So one last thing, if you can go onto the website and just fill out the feedback form so that in years to come we can improve the conference. But if you can just say thank you to Carly, and I hope you enjoyed her session.